traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
I am here with Alfonso Pecatiello, known on Twitter as the Macro Alf, and he has a website, Substack, the Macro Compass. We are here because of Alfonso's views about inflation. Now, as we all know, inflation has been a pretty big, very big buzzword here in markets recently. A lot of concerns about inflation, and commodities prices have been ticking higher. Bonds yields have been ticking lower, which is not a sign of inflation, but there are nevertheless a lot of concerns about inflation. It's something that people look for in Fed minutes. Any Fed commentary about inflation could lead to higher interest rates and Fed tapering. At least that's concern. Inflation, higher prices, higher gas prices, higher wages. These are all things that have investors on edge a little bit. So Alfonso here has a very contrarian view on this, and he is not concerned about inflation. In fact,
no.
He is very much about disinflation, which is different from deflation, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But Alfonso, give me your views here of inflation and why the concerns about inflation are misguided.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, by the way.
Thanks for coming on.
I really appreciate this. So the first thing I'm going to say here is that yes, we are going to see inflation for the next few quarters. We're probably going to see core PCE in America around 3% for the next 2 to 3 quarters, but that's it. We go back to structural trends. We go back to the disinflationary trend that basically we have seen for the last 40 years, since 1980s. We're going back there, and actually, I guess, pretty soon as well, in the next 2 to 3 quarters. And then, we're back to our secular forces. So I believe this is all temporary. And the hype around there in reflationary trades and market commentaries about inflation is way overdone. So I also think the peak in bond yields is what we have seen in this cycle at 1.75% in 10-year treasuries. I think it was May. And that's the best you're going to see if you're looking for higher yields. Now, on 10-year treasuries, we're already going down to 1.3%, but I think we're headed lower as well as we go into next year.
Headed even lower than 1.3. Okay.
Yeah. I guess so. So the reason why I bring this thesis out is because every time we have a credit-induced sugar rush, reflation period, you hear all the bond bears and all the secular inflation guys jumping on the wagon and screaming on higher yields and higher structural inflation. But it just doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is because we have very poor structural growth. It's here to stay, and it's driven by stuff you can't change. It's horrible demographics. You have your labor supply in America that will shrink year-on-year basis for the next 20 years. If your labor force is X millions, next year is going to be X minus Y millions. So if you have less people in the working force, these guys are also going to be able, to produce lesser output, assuming equal productivity. Actually, productivity itself is pretty stagnant as well. In Europe, even worse than in America, but in America, it is stagnant. And it is a byproduct of capital misallocation that comes from super easy policy stance from central banks. So it's a vicious circle. You have very stagnant productivity, you have horrible demographics. It's very difficult to produce structural growth. And so what we try to do every time we face a crisis and we can't produce structural growth is we overlay cyclical growth. How do we do that? We simply create money out of thin air. And here, it's not central banks creating money. It's the government by a fiscal spending, and it's commercial banks by lending new money into existence. Central banks accommodate the process. They create reserves. They swap these assets. They move away the bonds and they give reserves to banks. But you know, this new credit, which is created and flows into people's hand today at the expense of, you know, future generations, because we're simply borrowing more today, actually leads to a cyclical sugar rush, as I call it, reflationary impulse. And every time you have this kind of impulse, everybody jumps on and says, wow, this is a regime change. It must be different this time. We're going to see inflation at 5% for the next 10 years. No, we are not, because for every sugar rush, credit-induced sugar rush, there is always a credit cliff. It's always there. It's coming. Now, credit impulse all over the world has peaked in Q4 20. It has been massive. I mean, America has printed ridiculous amount of fiscal deficits compared to the output gap. Even in Europe, for Christ's sake, we have done some fiscal stimulus, which is very rare for us over here. But it is fading away already. The effect is there. It has been, the money has been spent, or should I say created, by the government. It has been put in the hands of people. And actually, it's interesting to see that 50% of Americans have not even spent this money. They've used it to repay former debt, or they've saved with this money. So that already tells you something. The private sector does not look for additional credit. It's overleveraged. Even if you try to slosh them with credit, they won't spend it. But at some point, this credit is over. The effect of fiscal stimulus is over. So you face the fiscal cliff, you're over-indebted, you're over-leveraged, you have poor structural growth capacity, the private sector doesn't want to borrow more, and you go back to the good old trends. Mm.
Okay, there's a lot of stuff in there for us to unpack it. But it sounds, for starters, it sounds like you are kind of in the Fed's camp that all of this inflationary effect is transitory, to steal their term. So it sounds like you buy that.
Yes, definitely. So what we're seeing now is the perfect combination of supply bottlenecks, which are, I guess, almost a definition or something to just be there when there is a pandemic. You will have supply bottlenecks. That's okay, I guess. Those supply bottlenecks, by the way, will be solved. Not all of them, but at some point they will be solved. Would you expect the producer of commodities to just dial back when he has commodity prices where we are? Of course, if you shut them factories because they can't, you know, reopen because of a pandemic, they won't reopen. But once the pandemic restrictions are lifted, which is happening, by the way, what do you expect the commodity producers to do with these prices? He's probably going to try and produce more, of course, to lock in these huge profit margins he has today. So those supply bottlenecks, as you basically take away COVID restrictions, are going to be, you know, slowly solved. The other side of the equation is the aggregate demand, which was absolutely boosted in a huge fashion by fiscal stimulus. But here again, I'm asking a question here. The fiscal stimulus you saw in 2020 and early 2021, will you see another round or even a bigger round? Because don't forget, we measure inflation on a year-on-year basis. So in order to continue to have 4% and 5% inflation next year, you will be comparing to this year inflation basket. So then I'm asking you, do you expect in Q4 2021, the US government to come in with a 10 trillion fiscal stimulus again, or an even larger one? No, you don't expect that. You actually expect them to roll away some of the stimulus that was there. So the aggregate demand boost is simply going to fade away. It's just a mechanical fiscal cliff or a credit cliff. We see that every single time. The Trump administration went in 2018 with a pretty big fiscal stimulus, and the output gap was estimated to be negative back then. They came in, massive fiscal stimulus. Yes, we saw growth. We saw wage growth. We saw unemployment rate at 3.5%. By the way, even then, core PCE went to 2%, and that was it. And then what do we see in 2019 once this effect fades away? Well, you see, you know, growth slowing down and the Fed being forced again into the good old cutting cycle. This is no different, absolutely no different.
Yeah, interesting points. Well argued, for sure. I do want to just challenge you on some of that, partly because it's my job and partly because I know that you like it. But when you look at these things, a lot of these prices and of things are cyclical and can be scaled back. Gas prices are a perfect example. But if you look at other things, some it's going to be hard to kind of put the genie back into the bottle. Wages are one example. Now, wage growth hasn't been all that dramatic yet. I think the last Fed report, or I'm sorry, the last unemployment report, the non-farms payroll showed it in line with expectations around 3%. Still, that's not nothing. And it's probably more than it has been. And that's just hourly workers. And it's more than it has been probably in quite some time. I don't know that for sure. But the point is that there is a lot of liquidity sloshing around the system. And a lot of these prices that are being adjusted higher aren't just going to come down. The guy down on the corner where I get my sandwich is, you know, charging now $12 or $13, whereas 10 years ago, he was charging $7 or $8. He's not just going to, you know, adjust his prices downward when there's less inflation, I would suspect. Maybe he will. I don't know. But those are, so what do you make of all that? The wage growth, and then also the fact that this will see it kind of be seen in other parts of the economy. Like you look at asset prices, real estate too is going gangbusters. And those are all parts where one could argue that inflation is being seen and felt.
So good points, by the way. I like to be challenged. That's right.
Yeah, I know.
That's so let's talk about first sandwich guy, right? So he's going to charge you more for his sandwich, all right? So this year you're going to see, assuming the sandwich is sitting in the core PCE basket, it's not, but let's assume it is.
Sure.
Then this year compared to last year, you're going to see an increase of 10% or 5% from that, you know, that single item in the basket, all right? Then you're saying his price is not going to be lower next year. Cool. Let's assume his price is going to be the same next year. Just the same. He's not going to lower it, but it's going to be the same, right? So assuming now the core PCE basket is only made by that sandwich, do you know what inflation year on year is going to be next year if the guy doesn't move the price? It's going to be 0%. Yeah. So what people fail to understand is that in order to have increasingly higher and out of hand inflation, you need not only the absolute level of the inflation basket to be higher, to be high, but you also need the acceleration in this pace of change to be higher every year. Otherwise, you're not going to achieve year on year changes that are higher and higher as we go. It's a bit like saying the government has done deficits for 10 trillion. Then next year they're going to do 10 trillion. Okay, that's exactly the same as last year. So you need a constantly accelerating pace in order to generate year-on-year inflation. So how do you achieve that? Yeah, wage growth is one of the ways in which, you know, once you start with people demanding higher wages, then they're probably going to try and demand higher wages down the road again. Now, the issue that I have is that people compare this period with 1970s, for example, and they say, look, you know, one of the drivers of inflation in 1970s was also that wages were going up. So the purchasing power in real terms was going up year on year on an accelerating pace. And that, of course, drove people to spend more and therefore inflation picked up. Now, in the 70s, you had labor unions that were really, really, really powerful. And you didn't have a scalable, huge force, which is tech. Now, nowadays, you have the opposite. You have labor unions that are less and less powerful. You have more decentralized, let's say, wage bargaining. And then you have tech, which is scalable and needs, I think I read somewhere, 1/10 of the employees to generate the same million of sales than you needed in the 70s. It's pretty hard to think that, you know, with such a huge portion of our service economy being redirected towards tech, you will be able to have wage bargaining power with these guys. This is not an industrial age. We're not living in the 70s. That's much, much different today. So I would argue wage growth, yes, sure, temporarily is going to print the 3%. It has already done so, by the way, for a while, but it will be dialed back as well as any other cyclical reflationary hype that we're seeing right now.
Very interesting. Okay, I guess that, so no concerns about inflation then. And you know, you do have some good points about the year-over-year prices, but and you don't think that the consumers are out there in force and that a lot of this money is going to find its way back into the economy? Do you think they're going to continue to use it to pay down debt and other things like that?
So one indication of that is to look at bank lending, because if you're the government and you want to print money and slosh people with checks, you can. And then it's up to them what they do. But the demand for endogenous structural credit, so bank loan demand, that tells you a lot. So if you look at the demand from the private sector for bank loans, despite extremely low yields, it's terrible. It's terrible because these people are already over-leveraged. They don't see an outlet for productive investments. They just don't see that. Neither corporates nor households actually see that. So they're shrinking demand. And actually, banks are not lending anyway, because for them, it doesn't make too much sense. I mean, return on equity on these loans are terrible. regulation and the capital you have to attach to these loans is pretty high and the loan yields are pretty low. So from a bank perspective, it doesn't make much sense to lend, but also the demand side for credit is pretty low. And when that happens, it tells you that the private sector is over-leveraged. And I mean, an example, again, as we discussed before, is that the US printed large amounts of money and 50% of that was not used to actually, you know, consume, but was rather used to pay down debt. And that already tells you something. I mean, the private sector is over-leveraged. And by the way, the private sector cannot print money to pay back their debt. They need cash flows. I mean, a corporate cannot print money. They need cash flows to service their debt. A household needs cash flow to serve the service their mortgage. If they think they're over-leveraged and they don't have prospects of, you know, rosy growth of their cash flows down the road, they're not going to borrow more.
Hmm. Interesting. And the higher prices that we're seeing, and again, not all of them will be adjusted downwards, but that's not going to take a hit into household spending and curtail anything like that?
Well, I mean, I guess price increases are going to be sticky. That's okay. Some other price increases might be dialed back. And what that means is that actually this is in a PCE basket, this is deflationary year on year. I mean, you reduce prices, so a certain component of the PCE basket is going to turn negative next year. So simply on this basis, on a base effect basis, let's say, it's very hard to foresee medium-term inflation at 4-5%. You asked another question before, which we didn't touch upon, which is real estate. And that is a little bit different because I think the objective of the governments out here is to keep real interest rates lower than real GDP growth. So what this does is effectively it inflates away your debt burden. So you refinance at the real interest rates in America today, which is negative, which is amazing, right? And then so on an inflation adjusted basis, you're effectively inflating away your debt. You pay a nominal rate of 1% to refinance, then inflation is 1.5%. So on a real debt burden level, you're actually reducing your debt burden, right? What this does on the consumer side is exactly the opposite. So people that are putting their money in a bank account or buying risk-free assets like treasuries today, they're seeing their purchasing power reduce over time because they get 1% in nominal yields, but then inflation is 1.5%. So in real purchasing power terms, they literally lost money. And I think this is basically a stealth way to, let's call it default, rather than in nominal terms, in real terms. So what you're doing is you are basically, by a financial repression, punishing savers and consumers in order to make sure that you can inflate the way you're over-levered, your debt burden, basically. And yeah, this basically forces people to find alternatives. They will find ways to invest their money, which is not in risk-free assets or on a bank account. And real estate is one of the ways, right? I mean, you borrow yourself today at mildly positive real interest rates. So maybe let's say in Europe, you borrow at 2% for 30 years, you expect inflation to be 1% or 1.5%. So in real terms, you're borrowing at 0.5%. And then you're putting this money in bricks and land, which is scarce by definition. And people would prefer that rather than, you know, being charged by definition, negative real interest rates as a sum of, well, 0% nominal yields on a bank account, if you're lucky, because in Europe, you're going to negative nominal interest rates on bank accounts, inflation rate, and some sort of a wealth tax that you have to add on top as well. So people are looking for alternatives, and that makes sense.
Right. So then what is driving all of this money into bonds? And you said it, like you're not getting returns on these things. I mean, the risk-free rate is very low indeed. The 10-year is 1.3%. And, you know, temporary or transitory or not, you have inflation. The price, the purchasing power of your dollars or your euros or your yen today is not the same as what it's going to be 10 years from now. Why would anybody? And then you have assets that are attractive, real estate, even stocks, right? Why would anybody put their money into bonds? And why do bond yields continue to fall?
Yeah, so the answer to the first question is that there are so many institutional investors out there that don't have a choice. The reason why they don't have a choice is regulation. So if regulation forces you effectively to be a fixed income investor, if you're a pension fund, for example, you have certain rules to adhere to. And one of it is that you must be liquid and you must have some sort of a fixed return on your asset side. Although now you can't service the return you're supposed to service on the liability side, by regulation, you're forced to invest in fixed income. If you're an insurance company, that's the same. If you're a bank treasury, that's the same. So I call institutional investors regulatory driven price takers. They don't
regulatory driven price what?
Price takers.
Price takers. Okay, sure.
They're not price setters, they're price takers. I mean, they have to be invested in bonds, and they can have a lower portion of their liquidity buffers invested in bonds if they prefer to have cash instead. But guess what? Cash is yielding even lower than your 10-year bonds. So, you know, by definition, some of these guys will have to buy. Then there is the multi-asset class cohort.
Well, hang on a second. The same thing, sorry to interrupt, but the same thing could be said for stocks. They also have a fixed allocation that they have to do to stocks, but stocks don't keep going up, especially now. And so it's not like they, is it the fixed income allocation different where they have to, because it just doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, the fixed income part is more regulatory driven than your stock allocation. So there is more regulation that binds you really to invest in fixed income, I would say. And then the other thing is that for the last 40 years, let's not forget that fixed income has performed incredibly well. Sure. And it also acted as a diversifier against your risk assets in the portfolio. Now, I would argue that the payoff of your bonds today that should act as a counterbalancing effect against your risk assets, it's pretty poor. Because in real terms, you pay a premium to be invested, negative real interest rates effectively, that's a premium, it's like an option premium. And then the option payoff out of this bond investment, it's actually pretty poor. It's not convex. I mean, there is a nominal lower bound at some point at which these bond yields probably can't go lower than that anymore. And therefore your payoff is not that convex. So from a diversifier point of view, if you want to call it like that, they're less attractive, but from a regulatory standpoint, tons of people out there are forced to be invested in this asset class.
Interesting. So what caused then the spike up in yields to 1.75 or whatever the high was a couple months ago? And if memory serves, at the same time, stocks were selling off too. What happened there?
So of course, you have the temporary reflationary trade, which always happens. I mean, it has happened as well under Trump. I mean, we saw 10-year yields at 3% back then, right? So it's a combination of two things. It's a repricing of the Federal Reserve hiking cycle down the road, and it's also repricing of term premium. So term premium is this weird component which basically represents the premium a long-term bond investor wants to own for holding long-term bonds rather than rolling bills effectively. So instead of, if I want to own fixed income for the next 30 years, I have two options. I can buy 3-month bills and roll them for the next 30 years every time they expire, when I can just buy today a 30-year bond, right? I can do both. If I buy a 30-year bond today, I'm exposed to certain duration risk and interest rate risk, right? So I want to be rewarded also for that. In theory, I want to be rewarded for the structural growth we're able to generate, the trend inflation we're able to generate, and some sort of term premium, right? So when yields were going up and the Federal Reserve was saying, look, we are in a reflationary period, but we don't really care. We're going to be doing flexible average inflation targeting. We're going to let inflation overshoot because, you know, we have undershoot for so long that we don't see the problem with inflation running higher than 2% for a while. It also basically puts more term premium required by investors to buy these long-end bonds, because the distribution of probabilities of future events 10-year, 20-year, 30-year down the roads starts to become much more scattered. You don't know whether the Federal Reserve is playing with fire, if their stance is too aggressive regarding, you know, letting inflation overshoot. And as you effectively cyclically see this inflation coming, you start demanding higher yields, higher term premium to buy these long-end bonds, right? It's exactly the opposite what's happening today. People are smelling in the bond market that the peak of the growth impulse and the credit impulse is behind us. So when that happens, you're probably slowing down on the growth trajectory. And at the same time, you have the Federal Reserve that is telling you, actually, we saw inflation printing a couple of times, 3-4%. We're not that sure we're going to let it overshoot for so long. We'd rather start acting. We'd rather start tapering and even discuss an hiking cycle. So what that does, it actually makes the future distribution of probabilities for long-term nominal growth down the road much less scattered, because you know the Federal Reserve will act if something starts to move, you know, too much into the overheating territory, which means long-term, you are more secure that the trend is, you know, more confined within a certain band. And therefore, the term premium you demand for buying these bonds is lower, and that helps pushing the 30-year bond yield down, which is exactly what's happening today. Mm.
What would you need to see from the Fed to kind of change your outlook here and to change your equation? I mean, One thing about the Fed is that they've showed in past cycles that they've kind of kept their foot on the gas a little bit too long. You know, I remember the early 2000s, the Greenspan Fed, and then I guess Bernanke came in and started raising pretty much, anyway, it doesn't matter. But the point is that they kept rates at zero for way too long, which led to the real estate bubble to become even more inflated. And they've done that a couple of times. One could argue they did it in 99. And then, you know, what do you make of that argument that the Fed, yeah, they could be talking a lot about hiking, but once the market freaks out for whatever reason, they will stick to their kind of growth at all costs mantra and keep printing longer than they want to.
Yeah, it's a good question. There are two ways to sort of rebalance the imbalances in the system. One of it is a pretty large wealth destruction up front. So you need all these excesses to be cleaned out. You need the current generation to be hugely punished for the excesses that we have accumulated in monetary policy, but also in how much credit we have taken on board over the last 40 years. And I'm always wondering which elected official is ever going to be wanted to be recorded in the history books as the guy that, you know, effectively wiped out one or two generations of wealth, because that's what's actually required. I mean, to bring back the S&P to some reasonable valuations, you would need to drop of about 50 to 60% at least. And the S&P is always used as the barometer, but if you look at where the wealth is distributed all over the world, global real estate accounts for 57% of the global market cap portfolio. So if you measure the market cap of each asset class all over the world, real estate is at 57% of all the global wealth. So if real estate starts to reprice, and it's an asset which is inherently leveraged because of mortgages, obviously, if that starts to reprice, it's a complete mayhem. I mean, it has implications for the labor market, for the consumers, for families. You'll have to see unemployment rate going up. I mean, it's a major restructuring, unprecedented. That's one way. And, you know, if it happens by coincidence or by accident, like the pandemic was probably one of these potential accidents, then at least people could blame an external agent. But which elected official is going to go for this solution, you know, by his own choice? Mm. No one is.
Yeah.
So then the alternative solution is to basically make sure that we go for financial repression. And as we are overleveraged, we try to punish savers and consumers with negative real interest rates. And, you know, we hope to inflate away some debt. But these negative real interest rates bring other sort of bubbly phenomenon, like real estate prices going through the roof. And investors start to look for any risk assets they can reach on, because they don't want to be charged 2 or 3% on a real basis every year and lose their purchasing power. So it's not a good situation where to be in, to be honest.
Mm. But yet it kind of describes every single business cycle of the last 30 years, doesn't it? And we had in 08, a big meltdown in real estate. And we saw, you know, what happened. It was indeed very ugly. But then the Fed just came in and started printing money again.
If I would have to really call something a game changer, I would have a look at the central bank digital currency experiment. So the reason why I pay attention to this is that at the moment, central banks cannot lend money. They can swap existing assets for bank reserves. So they go to a pension fund and they say, you bought a bond a year ago. Here is my QE. I'm actually going to create reserves and I'm going to take this bond away from you. And you're going to be stuck with these reserves. And you'll have to deposit these reserves in the banking system, and you'll have to start chasing again for new assets to buy. Right? That's what the central bank can do today. That's what they do. The central bank cannot lend money, cannot reach the real economy straight away, immediately. The agent to reach the real economy straight away, immediately, is the commercial bank. So the commercial bank can lend to me or you, and we can then go away and spend this money, right? So with central bank digital currency, theoretically, if you bring them to the extreme, you could have a central bank that actually circumvents the commercial banking sector and allows me or you to have an account at the Fed or at the ECB or the whatever it will be. And in this account, you can transact, but you can also basically get credit, the credit line out of this account. So that would be a game changer. That would be a central bank that reaches straight away the real economy and can extend or contract credit basically at their own will, without having to convince or, you know, sort of negotiate terms of these lending conditions with commercial banks that are free to lend out or not lend out. That would be a game changer.
A game changer for good or for bad?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
That would be a game changer in terms of the probabilities to generate inflation.
Okay.
Because you would have a central bank that is able to reach the real economy straight away. Doesn't need an intermediary. Credit will reach the real economy straight away. But, you know, is this really going to solve the problem long term? I mean, if we are an aging population that is unproductive, how are we going to produce structural growth? I mean, we can borrow more and more. We can become more and more over-leveraged. But, you know, this is not a structural fix. It's just a bigger band-aid. That's what it is. Mm. But it would be a game changer in terms of how do you need to price a distribution around inflation. So that change would you know, force me to reconsider my disinflationist stance, because now you have all of a sudden central banks able to reach the real economy straight away.
But failing that, you are still in the disinflationary camp. You still don't think that the Fed and the central banks can produce the inflation that that scares people.
No, I mean, and again, I stay in that camp simply because I see an over-leveraged private sector. It's massively over-leveraged. Private debt to GDP in America is 165%. And when you think of that, you can't think of the government able to just borrow again and print its own currency. I mean, the private sector is a currency user, mm-hmm. not the currency printer. So the private sector needs the real cash flows, and these guys are over-leveraged. And that leads them to have less credit demand. And as they have less credit demand, their appetite for credit going forward. These guys are not going to, you know, borrow to go into productive investments. They're just going to try to save more or to pay down their debt. And when you have these dynamics coupled with tech, coupled with aging demographics, coupled with horrible productivity, I just can't see any long-term aggregate demand push. I mean, to generate inflation long-term, it's one thing to have supply bottlenecks to generate short-term inflation. Long-term inflation comes from sustained boost to aggregate demand over the long to medium to long term. And given the conditions I've just described, I can't see where this strong and sustainable push to aggregate demand is going to come from.
Fair enough. All right, Alfonso Pecatiello, let's take a short break. I want to come back and I want to give our sponsors a chance to be heard and also come back and ask you some more questions about, if we could, about assets in particular, what this might mean for investors. But let's first take a short break. If you're a premium subscriber, don't touch the dial. You're not going to get the break. And to sign up to be a premium subscriber, go to contrarianpod.substack.com and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
Okay, welcome back, everybody, here with Alfonso Pecatiello, known as the Macro Alf on Twitter and the Macro Compass. He has his little Substack subscription there, which, by the way, I recommend signing up for. Alfonso, this is the section of the show where we ask our guest about themselves personally, how they came to this stage of their in life as investors or economists or whatever it is that they are. And so, yeah, so curious about your path and how you got where you are today. You mentioned your earlier offline that you're in the south of Italy, where it's quite hot, as it is here in the northeastern U.S., which is July, I guess, to be expected. But anyway, yeah, take it away. Tell us more about you.
Hey, thanks for the chance. So basically, I'm Italian, but that's, I guess you've already gotten that by my accent in the last 20 minutes or so. But I actually live in the Netherlands, which is a small country in north of Europe.
Yes, I've heard of it. Different country from Italy, yes.
Yes, very much. And the reason why I got into this business was that I was very curious when I was 14, 15. My mother is a treasurer of a very small bank in the south of Italy, and we were having lunch, at school breaks. And she was always with this computer on this lunch table, and she was looking at charts, and I'm like, I mean, what the hell is that? And she says, yeah, this is a BTP future, which is, you know, it's like a domestic government bond future from Italy. And she was trading that for the treasury of her bank. And I was very fascinated by these charts going up and down. I wanted to understand what was driving what. I mean, why it's going up, why it's going down, and, you know, what actually does this represent? And so she started explaining a bit, and I started reading some books. And at some point, I realized I really liked that. I always liked connecting the dots on a macro, very, very broad macro sense, like, you know, what's driving what? Is unemployment rate going up or down? Do we have a shrinking labor force or an expanding labor force? And what does it do to government bonds and then to equities and then to credits and to other stuff? So connecting the dots was the part that I liked the most. And finance and broad macro seemed actually to fit that appetite for knowledge and connecting the dots very well. So then I went to university, studied it, macro, then did some quantitative finance course with option pricing and stuff like that. And then started in finance, basically in treasury, managing a fixed income book. And, you know, it has been a nice journey, especially when you become a more institutional investor, you're able to see things from a different lens. Mm-hmm. So you still wear your hat of a broad macro top-down analyst. You're able to see what's going on, but you also have a better understanding of how much regulation is impacting decisions out there. And, you know, how these real money investors, as they're called in jargon, so insurance, pension funds, banks, etc., move their capital and take their investment decisions, which sometimes is, I should say, pretty funny and unexpected. But you learn that, and that's been a good journey.
Very interesting. And so you're in the Netherlands, hail from Italy. And now what are you, okay, so let's talk some now about the outlook for economies and we can talk about bonds or other asset prices. Obviously, the understanding is that neither of us are offering investment advice here and should not be viewed as investment advice. So, but yeah, what is your kind of top-down view of economy and markets right now?
So before we jump into that, just to make a small disclaimer adding to yours, I'm here just representing myself. I do not speak on behalf of my employer. My views do not necessarily represent my employer's view. This is just me talking about my private account investments, basically, and what I would do, which doesn't mean you have to do the same.
Got it.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
So talking about economies and asset classes. So the way I look at the world now is that I think the market is smelling that the credit impulse has actually peaked in Q4 20. If you run the numbers, it has peaked in Q4 20. Growth expectations and earnings expectations are through the roof. It is basically the inheritance of the reflation trade of Q1 21, where everybody got very excited about the growth prospects. This year, we're going to have a massive growth in the US, but the average Bloomberg expectation, economist expectation for US nominal GDP growth this year is 10% year on year, 2021 versus 2020. And earnings are priced to be 44% higher compared to last year. So you might want to argue from an expectation perspective, most of the good news is actually priced in. What's not fully priced in, and maybe the market is starting to smell this now, with lower long-end bond yields, with cyclicals actually taking a little bit of a beating, with certain commodities also down 40 to 50% from their May peaks, take lumber as an example. And with cyclical stock sectors doing much worse than the secular growth sectors, is that, you know, this expectation might be disappointed later this year. Mm. You know, the effect of the credit impulse fading away and the Federal Reserve coming in and wanting to tighten a bit, with other central banks then being free to follow. So once the Federal Reserve starts and you are maybe the European Central Bank, you can start thinking about tightening your own monetary policy without being afraid of euro dollar going to 140 because the Federal Reserve has already started. So, you know, at that point, you will have a little bit of a cycle of central banks tightening their monetary policy, which is understandable, I would say. But that happens maybe at the moment when a real hard data is starting to disappoint a little bit as we go into the end of the year. You saw the ISM data yesterday, they were already disappointing a tiny bit compared to expectation, and the market took a little bit of a growth scare. So in my Macro Compass publication on Substack, which is called the Macro Compass, inspired by this four quadrant approach that I have to macro investing, right? You have, you know, we're basically in this quadrant moved on the y-axis and on the x-axis by two components. One of it is the credit impulse. So are we literally creating credit or are we deleveraging? So is more money, like spendable inflationary form of money flowing towards the economy, or are we deleveraging? So are we destroying money? Are we paying back our debts effectively? So what is the cycle there? And on the other side of the axis, you have the central bank monetary policy stance against expectation and in a dynamic sense. And what I mean is that you don't need to look at the absolute level of accommodation, but both at the pace. So effectively, where are we moving? Are we becoming more or less accommodative? And how fast are we moving against consensus, right? So those are the two, the y-axis and the x-axis of this quadrant. And then you have four quadrants basically of this compass, and then you have four quadrants within the compass. And, you know, we had moved in Q1 21 to the part of the compass that is the most positive for high beta risk assets. So emerging market FX, cyclical stocks, banks, all that stuff, and the worst one for bonds. And that happens where you have created credit, you have pushed credit through the real economy. So earnings are going up and there is this reflationary sentiment, and you have a central bank that is still on the accommodative side. So what this does is that it steepens the yield curves because the long-term nominal growth projected goes higher as you have an accommodative central bank in the face of a growing economy, right? So, and that leads money to flow into the high beta risk asset classes, right? So emerging markets were doing good and commodities were doing good and all that stuff. And now we are definitely transitioning towards the left side of the compass. The left side, because I know for sure that credit creation has actually peaked in Q4 last year, and it leads all asset classes and GDP growth, by the way, the 12-month horizon, 8 to 12 months, depending on which asset classes are you looking at. So late summer to fall, you should start seeing the effect of this credit cliff actually hitting hard data and sentiment data. This doesn't mean necessarily that equity markets have to drop off the cliff straight away, right? It also depends from what is the reaction from the Federal Reserve and other central banks. Now, as we transition to the left side of the macro compass, you effectively have two quadrants left. One, which is really, really bad, and it's when credit creation decelerates and central banks, remain tight compared to what the market would require them to be to accommodate the process of a slowing economy. And in that case, you have all risk assets doing poorly, you have volatility going up, you have the dollar going well, which is, you know, a wrecking ball for risk assets from commodities to emerging markets. That's a pretty poor quadrant. And normally it lasts very little because central banks jump back in and try to ease the monetary stance again and, you know, calm down the markets. Or you might want to move to the other left quadrant. And the other left quadrant is the secular quadrant. It is the quadrant where credit creation is pretty slow. We don't do much deficits. We don't borrow that much. We stagnate on the credit creation. So earnings are not massive. Real GDP growth is between 0 and 1%. Inflation is between 1 and 2%. You know, it's a little bit of a secular trend of disinflation effectively. And in that quadrant, you have the tech stocks, you have yields doing well, you have credit doing well, and you have the high beta sectors of the asset class spectrum out there doing not that well. So you have bank stocks not doing well, EM lagging behind DM, and so on and so forth. So basically, this is the last 10 years with some interruptions here and there. So, and here I'm in the process of discovering, are we transitioning towards, you know, this quadrant, so the secular quadrant, and the price action of the last month would validate that. So you had NASDAQ doing much better than the Russell. You had emerging markets lagging DM. You had bond yields doing very well. And you had financial stocks doing worse than their tech peers, for example, right? So this is the typical secular trends effectively. I still think there might be a risk later on that we take a little bit of a peek at the worst quadrant, because when the Federal Reserve, assuming they just go through with their tightening schedule, when that coincides with bad economic surprises that I would expect popping up from Q4 onwards, I think that's pretty much a toxic combination. And we're also overdue for a 5 to 7% correction in risk assets, which would just be healthy, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So I'd be relatively careful with your exposure to risk assets. I'd definitely prefer the low beta to the high beta. So the more secular trends, I'm talking about, you know, tech stocks rather than buying, you know, industrial commodity related stocks or EMFX, that stuff I would be rather away from. And, you know, the yield curve in America is supposed to flatten here, and it's already flattening because the Federal Reserve comes in and tries to hike rates maybe next year, then 5-year rates are supposed to go up, and 30-year rates are supposed to go down, reflecting structural forces. So, but I wouldn't exclude completely the chance we're going to see a drawdown, 5 to 7% in S&P somewhere in Q4. And, you know, the dollar also does well in that environment because you have all these emerging markets which are over-leveraged and they are indebted in dollar. They don't have access to the dollar. Maybe global trade is slowing down more than people think, they might think today. So these emerging markets don't have access to dollar exports to service the dollar debt. They scramble to get dollars, and then the DXY gets a bid, which is typical as well when risk assets reprice. Mm. So the dollar bearish thesis here as well, I think, is misplaced.
Right. Doesn't it take a little while though for higher interest rates to kind of take their effect in the economy? And if you look at past cycles, like, you know, even the most recent one pre-COVID, you had the Fed tightening from what, 2015 through 2018, and 2017 was, I think, one of the best years for stocks and risk assets in many years. And so so wouldn't that kind of postpone a little bit some of the nastier quadrant that you were talking about?
Yeah, it's also a matter of expectations, I would say. So in 2016, okay, we had the China slowdown, sure, scare, if you remember, right? So we repriced as well a lot of earnings down because, you know, China hard landing or soft landing. Do you remember all that discussion?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I was in.
So on a global, here you go. So on a global basis, you had a little bit of a scare coming from China. It led to repricing of earnings expectations back then. And the Federal Reserve was also much more cognizant of that and slowed down a little bit their hiking cycle in 2016 to then basically resume it again in 2017 and then in 2018. So don't take me wrong, it can be the case that the Federal Reserve is able to tighten monetary policy and accompany a recovery in a very gentle way. That is possible. The more the economy becomes over-leveraged, though, the less is there capacity to produce long-term structural cash flows. I mean, that's what the private sector needs in order to flourish and to be able to service their debt burdens. And I'm afraid that COVID actually worsened that situation. It wiped out something like, at the moment, 2% of the labor force in America has disappeared. Like, you know, participation rate went down from 63.5% to 61.5%, not recovered in the last year, basically, despite gradual reopenings, which is pretty scary. It might suggest that the part of the labor force in America has just disappeared. I mean, literally, they are not even interested in looking for a job anymore, these guys. And, you know, that actually dents the long-term ability to generate structural cash flows. And if the economy is not able to do that, then the Federal Reserve can only tighten so much before people effectively are struggling again.
Yeah. Has the Fed ever been able to engineer a soft landing? I guess you could argue maybe the 2018, you know, pre-COVID things were kind of okay.
Well, the first thing I would like to point out as an answer to that question is that, the Federal Reserve themselves are telling you what the terminal rate is supposed to be according to themselves, right? So right. If you go back to 2005, mm-hmm. you'll find the Fed fund terminal rate to be 4.5%. So the Federal Reserve thought they could hike rates in a normal hiking cycle all the way to 4.5%. And 4.5% was the nominal Fed fund terminal rate. So that is the rate that the economy can take literally and can function at equilibrium when that rate remains there. So you will have not overheating, not underheating. You will have just, you know, unemployment rate at Nairu and all these nice equilibrium models actually holding up very well. Now, this terminal rate, so it is the long-term on the dot plot of the Fed today, it's 2.5%. But the Federal Reserve has actually acknowledged that the economy can't take 4.5% long-term Fed funds rate. According to them, the next hiking cycle has to stop at 2.5%, unless something changes in the meantime and something structural changes. It means demographic turns, it means productivity goes up, it means, you know, all that stuff. But as per today, they think we can't go higher than 2.5%, right? So that's already something, I would say. It's a central bank acknowledging they're facing structural forces that they can't actually influence that much. If you then
hold on, is that all relative? I mean, couldn't 2.5% just be the new 4.5%?
Well, I guess the answer to that is yes, because as we discussed before, if you are more and more over leveraged, then at some point you just can't take higher rates. So the old 4.5% is now 2.5%. I would even challenge that view by saying that if you check what the actual hiking cycle of the Federal Reserve has been versus what they told you it would have been looking at the terminal rate, there's always been way lower than the terminal rate over the last 20 years. So Janet Yellen had the terminal rate at about, I think, 3.5% when she was in office. And, you know, the Fed funds rate never went to 3.5%. That's one example, right? So now the Federal funds rate at 2.5%, I would argue that the Federal Reserve maybe manages to hike a couple of times. Maybe. That's at best. So we're talking Federal funds rate at about maybe 0.5 or 0.75%. And that's it.
Wow. Okay. That's very low indeed. Okay. How soon do you think the Fed is going to hike?
Well, you know, if they would have a perfect path in front of them, what would happen is that effectively they get, you know, not much of a slowdown in hard data. So they get a decently positive few quarters of hard data that gives them the chance to taper their purchases from 120 billion to zero. It's a process that normally takes about 9 months, I would argue. Let's assume starting in September. And then you move to June next year, where you have zero purchases on net basis and the economy is still doing good, by the way. That's the assumption behind. And then you wait generally for about 3 months. That's what the textbook would say, to make sure that everybody knows that you're going to telegraph the first hike and what this hiking cycle should look like. And then late in 2022, you actually start hiking. And the bond market, up until I think a month ago, was pricing a full 25 basis point hike by December 2022, which is consistent with the story I'm saying. It's priced to perfection. It's very hard to imagine it gets quicker than that. It can. I mean, they can taper, and then maybe where they're buying only 20 billion a month, they can do the first hike. But that would be, you know, a bit outside the textbooks, right? So the textbook is first hike in, you know, September to December 2022. That's the earliest you can get. The last bond market move has actually wiped out that probability. Euro dollar futures are rallying, so forget about that. The market doesn't believe that anymore. But yeah, if they would, I guess they have an incentive to hike in 2022 and then to continue in 2023 as well if they have the chance. And the reason why the incentive is there is the zero lower bound. The Federal Reserve is at the zero lower bound, which means that assuming you get another crisis next year, you never know, right? Assuming it happens, how is the Federal Reserve going to react to that? I mean, from an interest rate perspective, they have nothing left, literally nothing left. And I say nothing because I don't think the Federal Reserve can ever apply negative interest rates, or, well, they can probably, but they really don't want to. And it's a geopolitical reason. The dollar is the reserve currency of the world. So people are trading in dollar, they're making loans in dollars. They do not want to hold the reserve currency of the world that actually charges them in nominal terms with negative nominal rates. They already are charged in real terms, but even charged even in nominal rates, I think, might be pretty much a geopolitical bomb. So they probably want to avoid it for as long as possible. But in order to avoid it, you need to get out of the zero lower bound as soon as you can. So I guess they will try. Will they succeed? Maybe a couple of hikes and that's it.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I know one thing the Fed could do if they need to. They could always just buy stocks, right? Remember, there's always some speculation about that in every recession. And so far, they haven't done it. But they're buying ETFs, right? Bond ETFs. But, you know, why not switch those to stocks? Could happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, they've bought corporate bond ETFs. So they're moving to things that you would have, you know, deemed unthinkable a few years ago. Yeah. I mean, they needed to set up an SPV basically to buy that stuff. Otherwise, it was against the law. So you have Bank of Japan buying equity ETFs. And at some point, the easiest way to compress risk premium out there and to calm down the market is to literally lift equities. Once you do that, then you send, and also the signal of your action is very, very strong. And it would, you know, make sure that people follow what you're doing. But again, we're not pushing on a string. Mm. And we are imagining the next crisis with federal fund rate probably at 0.5%, and then the next big crisis hit. And then, you know, I don't know for how long these authorities will be able to kick the can down the road without causing what I call a convex market reaction. So markets are very linear in nature until they're not. And you know, when something like that happens, then you need something in your portfolio that protects you against non-linear market action, liquidity disappearing, you know, and something moving as a straight line down rather than in a linear process. You then need instruments in your portfolio that are also convex rather than linear in their payoff. Options do that very well, if you know how to structure them. And in the past, as again, it was much easier to have a 60-40 portfolio with bonds doing the work for you most of the times in the drawdowns. But today, I think optionalities and tail risk hedging strategies should be part of your macro portfolio approach.
Yeah, yeah. Although historically, again, a lot of these risk protection things that assets didn't work very well, but the only thing that did was treasury, right? So,
yeah. And the other thing about this tail hedging strategies is that nobody likes them because they're very expensive. When things are going well, you literally need to set aside a budget, which will make you underperform your peers that are not buying insurance when it's cheap, right? They don't care. So, you know, in this industry has incentive schemes that force you to outperform every 3 months your peer group, right? So if you spend insurance premium buying out of the money options to get a convex payoff on any instrument and nothing happens, you lost money, right? Mm-hmm. So and you can lose money for a quarter, maybe for 2 quarters, but then your CFO or whoever your boss is will come to you and will say, "What the hell are you doing, man?"
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that can cost you a job. So the incentive schemes are not great, I think, for tail hedging strategies, but I think they might have, or they should have a place in your portfolio because the classic, you know, approach to equities and bonds as a risk-off instrument, I guess, might be less relevant today than it was for the last 40 years.
Yeah, and it didn't work, you know, in during COVID, and it didn't work in 08 either. So from what I recall, looking at some of these assets, I remember the Swiss franc sold off, gold sold off, everything, you know.
Yeah, because, you know, you become more and more over-leveraged, right? So mm-hmm. as long as you just want to survive when that comes. And in order to survive, you need to get your hands on cash and to pay your, you know, to make sure you can pay your margin calls when they come. So any asset you have, especially if it is in the money, and will make you money when you sell it. So gold or bonds or whatever it was, you just sell it. You get your hands on cash, because up until the day before COVID hit, everybody was in CLOs, in over-leveraged carry trades out there. And then it's a scramble just to get the cash in order to make sure you can repay your margin calls or your loans that you were having to basically fund your loans.
Yeah. All right, Alfonso, last question. How low do we go on the 10-year?
What's your time horizon?
Oh, well, no, this cycle, let's say. The next couple, yeah.
So this cycle, we might say for over the next, call a cycle, 5 to 7 years, I'm going to say anywhere between 0 and 0.5%. So that means Federal funds rate are at 0%, because I really think the Fed will have a hard time selling to the public negative interest rates. But then it means the term premium between 0 and 10 years is effectively close to zero. So you don't need any reward to buy a 10-year bond, because you will assume the Federal Reserve has no alternative than to keep rates at zero about forever. So basically, it's a Europeification, if that is an English word, or a Japanification of the US yield curve, where you have, you know, the 10-year yield is very, very close to the base rate, the front end rate, because there is no uncertainty around the policy path. It's just going to be zero forever. So and if I'm right, then 10-year yields can be as well 0.25 to 0.5%.
What was the lowest they got in COVID? It was like, what around 70, 60?
I think we saw 55 basis points or so.
And, and in 08, 09?
No, that would have been higher than that, I think.
Would have been higher than that, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, okay,
so
that, wow.
So this
so you think we'll get a historic low? You're talking about if it's below 50. Wow, okay, there you go.
And I don't know exactly when that happens. I only know that this long-term trend is very clear. So you had bond yields at 5% in 2006, and now they are at 1%, 1.25, 1.3% today. Next stop, it's in the structural trend all the way down, with some cycles around the trend, but the trend is very clear, and I don't see any way we can revert that in any form. So we're going to 0.5%.
Interesting. Very good. Okay, that's great. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Maybe in closing, tell our listeners how they can find out more about you. I mentioned your Twitter and your Substack, and I'll put that in the show notes as well. Macro Alf is the Twitter, at Macro, M-A-C-R-O-A-L-F. you took the German abbreviation of your name rather than Alfonso, but and the Macro Compass. What's the URL for the Substack?
So if you want to find me on Substack, you can just go on the web, on Substack website and type The Macro Compass, or otherwise just go on Google and type The Macro Compass newsletter. You will probably find me in the first results. Right. And my handle on Twitter is Macro Alf, as you correctly said. Mm-hmm. It has been an absolute pleasure being on the show. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. It's The Macro Compass at .substack.com is the URL. Thank you to Alfonso. Thank you all to all of you for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.